Okay.
I've got Pepe Escobar on from Asia Times. He's the political encyclopedia. Pepe, he wrote an excellent article on the French and the disaster in Geneva. Let's explain first what happened in Geneva and then explain why. Because there were a lot of hopes. I was glued to my computer screen. I was up all night naively thinking something good would happen. But what happened?
Yeah, the whole planet, I would say, was Ryan style waiting for something, right? But, well, I was in Paris following this, I would not even say it was a Voltairean drama or Proustian disaster, whatever that is. But it was very funny. On Friday night, I was at a dinner. And I was getting alerts from a friend every 5 minutes telling me details about what was going on in Geneva. It was absolutely fascinating. First of all, the Europeans, the Americans, and Iranians, in fact, they had been discussing for months a broad outline for an interim agreement. There will be a 6 month interim agreement before a final agreement regarding running enrichment, nuclear reactors, you name it. Then they had these 3 days of discussions with foreign ministers. Then it went from the Sherpa level to foreign ministry level. 3 days in Geneva where there were high expectations to break a deal. There were two basic sticking points. What to do with the Arak reactor, nuclear reactor.
That's the ARAK, not to confuse people.
ARAK, you bet.
Right.
And what to do with the amount of uranium that Tehran has already enriched. There were solutions, even during these past few days, for these two problems, especially negotiations between the Americans and the Iranians themselves. But then, guess what?
There's a French peacock on the stage.
The Gallic rooster appears from the middle of nowhere, literally, and, you know, scotched the whole deal. Yeah, why did this happen? Well, there's been a lot of, in the American press especially, there's been a lot of talk about good cop, bad cop. The Americans playing good cop and the French playing bad cop. No, not at all. There was a real disagreement between the Americans and the French. Obviously, you won't know, you really won't know about it if you follow Western mainstream media, including the French press. I was also glued to French media, press, TV, radio, blogs.
Pepe, I would say that for just about everything, you really won't know what's going on if you're dependent completely on Western media.
Point, Ryan. Spot on. All right, so backtracking a little bit. What the French media were saying, based on leaks by their own diplomats in Geneva, of course, is that France was extremely worried because Israel was not protected by this deal to be clinched, which is not true, first of all. What is true is that Hollande, President François Hollande, the most unpopular president in the history of the French Republic. This became official just a few days ago in the latest poll. He's even more unpopular than Sarkozy when Sarkozy was really down. So this gives us an idea how the French, as a whole, all over, crossover any regions from Bretagne to Provence, they think he's an absolute disaster.
This is the supposed socialist who's actually a right winger.
Progressive, exactly.
Yeah.
The Europeans as a whole as well, it's fantastic. They have a very interesting read in France, the Courrier International. It's a weekly. It's basically a digest of European press, Asian press, American press, best articles or more interesting articles from media from all over. The cover this week is Holland once again, and there are 6 pages of mostly European articles, German press, Italian, some American articles as well, saying how incompetent, paralyzed, and absolute disaster he is. Which is, so, you know, the feeling is shared by the French and by the Europeans. So the Americans were involved into what's going on inside France. So why is this a show of Gallic, you know, self-importance once again? There are two very important factors. One is the Israeli lobby in France, which many people in America probably don't know, is as powerful as AIPAC in D.C.
This is the CRIF.
CRIF, Conseil de Représentation des Institutions Juives, basically. They say that they represent Jewish institutions. Although, just like in the U.S., a lot of French Jews don't think they are really represented by CRIF. But they are very powerful on an institutional level. And obviously, they control a lot of parliamentarians. And very, very interesting, people at the highest positions in the Élysée, the presidential palace, and Matignon, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. For instance, just an example, the ghostwriter of François Hollande's speeches, in fact, he is a member of CRIF. And some of the most, outspoken parliamentarians at the Assemblée Nationale, they also are members of CRIF. So CRIF is very, very active, and they make sure that they have been making sure, in fact, for not only months, but years, that no deal with Iran is acceptable if they don't give their imprimatur, which means following the marching orders by the Likudniks in Israel. That's the Israeli lobby angle. The other angle, which is never touched upon in French mainstream media, only in passing. You need to read a few French blogs to find it, in fact, and talk, obviously, off the record with diplomats and businessmen, if they're willing to talk, is the GCC petromonarchy oil and gas lobby in France, which is extremely powerful. I would say that comparatively, it's even more powerful than the Gulf petromonarchy's lobby in D.C. There are a lot of contracts involved. Construction of plants, construction of nuclear plants, sale of Rafale fighter jets, you name it. Water, the big French water companies are also involved in, especially Saudi Arabia and the Emirates.
Hypocrisy that is. Oh, we don't want Iran to build nuclear plants, but we're going to build them for these Wahhabi nuts.
That's exactly the point. Like Areva, the big the French construction, nuclear, whatever. It's a huge conglomerate in France. They just clinched a deal to build nuclear power plants in the United Arab Emirates. And they want to clinch the same deal with Saudi Arabia. So this is something that I wrote in my article, in fact. In terms of apparently the French elite, they stopped doing irony. They were very good at doing irony historically for centuries. Now they don't see the irony of, okay, Iran cannot do it, but we can do it for our Wahhabi clients, which is completely absurd, right? So what is the power play involved? Hollande and Fabius, very important. Laurent Fabius, the guy who pulled the Peacock Act in Geneva, especially from Friday night to Saturday, when the negotiations really start to derail. There was a long session, in fact, that went from Friday night to early Saturday morning, in fact, where Fabius derailed the thing completely, and everybody was stunned. The Germans were stunned. The Brits were stunned, not to mention the Russians and the Chinese in the P5 plus one, five permanent members of Security Council plus obviously the Americans. The French were saying, which is not true, by the way, that Kerry showed up in Geneva. Kerry landed on late Friday, in fact. He arrived in Geneva with a different text compared to the text that the P5 plus one was studying with the Iranians. This is very hard to establish because the Americans, for instance, they said, no, we had discussed this before. There was nothing different about it. The French are saying, no, the text was completely different. So this is a very important point of dispute, right? And then Fabius, because he had the marching orders from Bibi Netanyahu, which gave the marching orders to Hollande, and afterwards Bibi called everybody.
After Obama called him and specifically said, don't sabotage these. So, of course, Netanyahu goes and calls everybody to try and sabotage it.
You're absolutely right. Obama called Netanyahu on Friday morning, and then later Netanyahu called everybody else to ask them to do exactly what Obama told him not to do, which is to bomb the negotiation. And the only one who actually followed it was Hollande. In fact, Hollande had been following it for, you know, since he came to power, in fact. French elites as a whole, either conservative or, in this case, so-called socialists, crypto-socialists like Hollande, Fabius, etc. The Jewish lobby is very important. They follow what the Likudniks in general are saying and tell them what to do. So Fabius, from the beginning, his task was to derail the negotiations. And obviously the French mainstream media will never admit it. Some blogs, in fact, were talking about this based on the usual moles that they have, which means dissatisfied diplomats inside the Ministry of Foreign Relations, which are usually the best sources you can have anywhere, right?
Right.
So from Friday night to Saturday, the whole thing was completely derailed, and the Iranians themselves start, Ambassador Zarif start asking himself, who am I negotiating with here? You know, so obviously that it was impossible to have a deal, even though they had, I would say, 80 to 90% of these two key issues, the Iraq nuclear reactor and the quantity of enriched uranium that Iran already has, they were more or less solved. And the proof that they were solved is that immediately after the talks collapsed, Iran reached an agreement with the IAEA regarding inspections of the Iraq nuclear reactor. So there was no technical issue with the French came up with this fictitious problem regarding the Iraq reactor. And the amount of enriched uranium would be discussed now, and it would be part of the interim agreement for the next 6 months. And then everybody will say, okay, you can keep some of this enriched uranium inside Iran. You have to destroy the rest. You have to transfer it to Turkey, Russia, or whatever that is. But the negotiations were ongoing. The craziest part after the whole thing collapsed, after the French Peacock Act, is that Kerry, which was being criticized by the French, he also changed his narrative. And now he's saying that the deal collapsed because of Iran, which is completely absurd. Everybody knows that the French scotched the deal. And now Kerry has been saying for the past 2 days, oh no, the Iranians were not ready for a deal at the moment. No, they were not ready for a deal when there was a internal dissension inside the P5 plus one. The P5 plus one, from one day to another, they didn't know what they wanted. It's simple as that. So this means basically that the conditions for a deal are there. There is a strong possibility that they could clinch a deal next week, November 22, in Geneva, when they're, the second leg of these negotiations. If nothing happens in November, they will have still a few months to iron out these differences. So the point is, I think, in my opinion, in the medium to short to medium term, let's put it this way, this alliance of fear, I call it the alliance of fear and loathing, the axis of fear and loathing, in fact. The Likudniks in Israel, the House of Saud, and France, they could block, scotch a deal for the next months or the next few months. But the Americans want a deal by all means. The Obama administration wants a deal. The Iranians want a deal. The ramifications of a deal in the long run are mind-boggling. We would need, you know, hours and hours of discussion to go about it. But
I think most of the world agrees with you there. I mean, most of the world saw this. This is a chance to, everybody knows this is a good thing to have a peace and to have a deal and to ease on the sanctions. Everybody knows that. We're just wondering, does even the government know that? Because they're always the last ones to do something right. And it got botched by the French, but they're reading speeches written for them by the Israeli lobby, by Israeli passport holding schmuck. And they can the whole thing, but it can't last forever. But my question is, in this time period they have before the next talks, won't the AIPAC, the Israeli lobby in the U.S., be pushing Congress to put more sanctions on Iran? And you know Congress is going to cave.
Yes, you're totally right. And I think this is going to happen, if I'm not mistaken, later this week, later the next few days, you know. So this is the American sabotage, internal American sabotage against the deal. Just like in Iran, you have, President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif, they are very much aware of sabotage by the Republican Guards. Revolutionary Guards. I'm sorry. I'm always with Iran in my head all the time. They don't want a deal as well. They are the hardliners inside Iran. So the hardliners in the West, the French, the Saudis, and the Israelis, and the hardliners in Iran, Revolutionary Guards, different factions, but
Jandala maybe.
they were in control of the nuclear dossier until recently. Recently means a few months ago. And Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, with the election of Rouhani, gave Rouhani a pass. Okay, go for your strategy. Let's see if it works. If it doesn't work, because especially of American internal American sabotage, U.S. Congress, and Israeli rhetoric and French actions like this past weekend, Khamenei will tell Rouhani, forget it. There will be no deal, and we'll keep on doing what we want to do. We will deal directly with the IAEA. They can have their inspections, but there will be no overall deal. Bad move for everybody, except obviously for the House of Saud and for Israel. I would say, in terms of political capital, in these past few weeks and months, the Obama administration, they have to go, I would say, no holds barred. If they really want a deal, they have to try to contain these petro-monarchy assholes in D.C. and in the Gulf, the Israeli lobby outside, in France, in Israel, and inside D.C. as well. And obviously, they have to fight Republicans, because Republicans, when you see what happened, provoked by France this past weekend, and you see Joe McCain and Lindsey Graham, let's applaud France. Do you remember the French fry thing 10 years ago? Now they're applauding.
Yeah, that was Walter Jones, who was my congressman, but he's pulled a complete 180, and now the same guy that proposed freedom fries is totally anti-war and anti-bailout and everything else. But I don't know how much of that is because he actually believes that, or because now there's a Democrat in the office and he just does the opposite of that. You know, who knows? But
they want if Obama is successful with this, let's say, crypto Nixon moment in China, now Obama Iran, it's a major geopolitical victory for the Obama administration. Don't forget that for the moment they have none. This will be, okay, one and only, but something that it would begin to erase the past 34 years, the famous wall of mistrust. And in the long run, it's a great deal for U.S. corporations, for Western corporations, for anybody who wants to invest in this phenomenally huge Iranian energy market. You name it. People who want to trade with Iran, including Europeans and including the French. The French are so stupid that they're shooting themselves again in their own backs. Peugeot was the number one car maker in Iran. They had to leave because of those stupid American European sanctions. European sanctions replicating the American sanctions. So they lost jobs inside France as well.
The ironic thing, too, is our president that's pushing for the deal, supposedly, when he was a senator, was the co-sponsor for putting sanctions on Iran. So he's trying to get rid of things that he helped make and create to begin with.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So the problem is how the Obama administration is going to fight Congress against this new package of sanctions. But there's one thing about this new package of sanctions. They are third-party sanctions. They are going to so-called punish other countries who trade with Iran. Nobody is going to respect this, just like nobody that really matters is respecting the current oil sanctions. Right. Don't forget exemptions for the Asian powers. China, for instance, they would never respect this stupidity, because for them, buying energy from Iran is a matter of national security for the Chinese. The Turks, they need Iranian gas. They won't respect it. And, Japan, South Korea, yeah. Everybody.
Post-Fukushima, no one's going to tell Japan they can't buy oil or gas from somewhere. They're just going to do it.
Telling Asian emerging powers, look, you cannot buy energy from Iran. This is beyond ridiculous. Huh? You know, it's for internal consumption of misinformed Americans. In fact, informed Americans know that this is bullshit, right? So this is what you're going to have in the... I'm very curious to what's going to happen in Geneva later next week. There is a possibility of... In fact, Kerry changed his narrative, but he's also saying that the building blocks for a deal are there. And Catherine Ashton, European Union, she's saying the same thing. The negotiations were good. They were not derailed. She said today, we are on the right track. So everybody wants this. The Russians and the Chinese, they're not even saying anything because they know that the problem is they cannot control the French, because Hollande is so, his situation inside France is so absolutely devastatingly horrible that he thinks that if he scotches this deal, it's a major French foreign policy victory. Just to give an idea how desperate these people are. You know, they think that they're going to be saved by Qatar buying whole chunks of Paris and investing in French companies, and they're going to sell nuclear power plants to everybody in the Gulf. Wahhabis, of course. I wouldn't bet my Brie farm on it, really, you know.
Yeah, but I don't know if they're being so stupid or just... the regular Israeli play card is just to bribe off the people in charge, so they personally profit, and they don't really give a damn about the country.
Of course not. And obviously, these people in the Israeli lobby in France, they are, like in the U.S., Israeli firsters. They don't care about what French investment, French companies, the state of French economy. In fact, Fabius, in fact, he doesn't know anything about economics. The Ministry of Finance in France, they are desperate because they have been downgraded again last week. In fact, it's very funny because during all this negotiation, the headline of all French newspapers was France has been downgraded by Standard & Poor's again. So soon we're going to be just like Spain and Italy, basket cases.
Although I don't give much credibility to the credit rating agencies, because they do a lot of things for political reasons. They did that to Hungary when they got rid of the IMF, and they're the ones that gave AAA ratings to all these mortgage-backed security bonds, which are absolute junk, and they knew it from the United States. So I don't give them a lot of credibility. I don't think they have any. They ought to. They do, but not from me.
Of course, they are not credible enough, but this downgrading, when especially European countries are downgraded, it just reflects the state, the extremely poor state of their finances. And France, they thought they were above the southern Mediterranean countries. No, they're not. And and their unemployment rates are absolutely horrible as well.
That's true. That's a real number too.
Worse than France. Even around Paris, I was talking to people that I know, friends, and a few sources as well. They said, look, if you had time, you should drive 3 or 4 hours inland, towards the southwest of France, for instance. You would see a situation very similar to Spain in terms of unemployment. And even in Paris, you see a lot of people who lost everything They have a meager savings and they're barely surviving. Or and obviously they cannot afford to live in Paris anymore. They are trying to find a shed in the Bretagne or Normandy countryside, you know, to survive. It's absolutely horrible. And this Holland government, not only they are incompetent financially and in terms of creating jobs, forget it. Out of the question, nothing. This was their number one promise when Holland was elected. So he managed to be even worse than Sarkozy, which I think is something for a neo-pro.
That's an accomplishment. It's like Obama outdoing Bush on a lot of things. Nobody thought, well, we can't get worse than W, good old Junior. But he did. He spent more in 8 months than Bush did in 8 years. So, but he's got more charm, so he can get away with it a lot more.
Exactly. And Holland on top of it, you know, in the charm department, even a cold cucumber in a market in Paris is more sexy, you know. Well,
I hope they can get rid of him. And do you think, I guess, I don't know, activism in the U.S. to tell Congress not to bow down to AIPAC for once? I mean, we seem to have staved off an attack on Syria at the last minute. Do you think we can break the apathy again, maybe? Because if Congress does vote on such a thing, at least we'll have that sort of litmus test to tell concretely who is working for Israel and who isn't. Because there's no reason at all. There's no benefit for the United States at all to have any sanctions on Iran. There's no gain. That's I see it for the Saudis. I see it for the Israelis. For the Americans, it's crazy. There's no gain in that.
And it's bad for American business, in fact. This is, but it's impossible because don't forget that these Israeli firsters in Capitol Hill, they are fanatics. You cannot have a rational, technical, enlightened conversation with these people. Not at all. And that's the problem for the Obama administration. How to convince these people, look, we are in the middle of an extremely complex negotiation. We got a break. We can have a deal. There won't be the possibility of Iran enriching uranium to, if they decide, build a bomb.
But that's just the thing. They all know they're not building a bomb. That's the excuse they give for why they want sanctions and everything. But they're not actually worried about Iran building a bomb. What they really are worried about is Iran becoming an economic powerhouse and challenge Israel's hegemony in the region.
Absolutely. And they, if they are not, if their IQ is above 15, I would say, they can see that Iran does very good business with Asian powers, has a strategic relationship with both Russia and China, soon is going to be a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, is going to be linked to China by this Chinese project of the new Iron Silk Roads, which means moving trade via railways all across Eurasia, in fact, and Iran is a crucial node for that. They know that sooner or later, Iran will be selling more oil and gas. As soon as there's a small alleviation of these sanctions, there are, you know, millions of customers, you know, knocking at the doors in Tehran. Okay, we want to do business with you. Including, of course, Western corporations. So this is good for business and for everyone. It's a win, like the Chinese say, this is a win-win situation. Of course,
you have to have over double digits in the IQ. And you called it correctly before in a previous interview. This is before the pipelines were built or anything, but we were just pushing Iran into the arms of China. When they couldn't go west with their pipeline because of the Syria situation, they built one east into Pakistan, and we all know that's going to go to China eventually. It's already going through a port that China built for them so that it can go to China. And so that's where the gas and oil is going to go, and that's a win-win.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, businessmen in the U.S., they see that. They have all this information at their fingertips. They say, look, we are losing out in all this thing. We should be there. We should be investing. And obviously, even if this is an Islamic regime, If you have a major Western corporation willing to invest in your oil and gas industry, you're going to do business with them. It can be Total in France, which was already there in Iran. It can be the Chinese, which are there. It can be Gazprom already there. And it can also can be Chevron, ExxonMobil, you name it. BP, you name it. You know, it's so obvious, but try to explain this to these fanatics in Capitol Hill, right?
Yeah, they're the last people, but they don't care. It's just, they have an ideological sort of fanaticism, the word to use is the best, just no, Iran is the enemy. And also, I think, sort of pointing the finger at Iran and saying they're so scary and building bombs and this big Muslim boogeyman or whatever kind of takes the heat off of those that actually are engaged in terrorism and doing all those things, like the Wahhabis from Saudi Arabia or the Zionists in Israel bulldozing down houses and assassinating people. Like, they're the ones actually behaving like that. Israel's the country that actually does have nuclear bombs that they built illegally and did so in secret, and are poisoning people with polonium and everything else and assassinating scientists. And they actually behave like that. But the narrative is, oh, Iran's the scary kid on the block. And as long as they can scream about that, it distracts everybody from their own issues and their own behavior, which is everything they're accusing Iran of, they're actually guilty of themselves.
Absolutely, Ryan. And in terms of deviating the narrative and, you know, the perfect excuse not to talk about the real issues, Iran is the perfect foil, you know. So the Israelis won't have to talk about what they're actually doing in Palestine, which gets worse by the minute, in fact. And the Saudis, especially, don't have to talk about, Qatar doesn't have to talk about the slavery society that they operate over there, which is rewarded, by the way, by Western investment, by getting the World Cup in 2022, you name it. You know, only now, it's very interesting. That's another thing I was discussing in Paris, in fact. Have you noticed that only now Western media is starting to talk about the actual slavery inside Qatar, and maybe we should talk again about World Cup in 2022. It's because Qatar fell from grace in the West. They overextended themselves. The Americans say, no, let's get rid of them. Bandar Bush, in fact, convinced the Americans to get rid of Qatar in Syria. So now Qatar is turning inward again. So obviously they are the criticism in the West. For the first time in years, you start to see Western mainstream media actually criticizing Qatar.
Is that because they were backing the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt against the military coup, which we won't call a coup?
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, these things can change. And obviously the Saudis, okay, they can be crooks, but they're not stupid. They're not foolish. They can see that the tide of international opinion can turn against them as well. Okay, more than already is, in fact. The fact that they invaded Bahrain, the fact that they would never allow even some stirrings of Arab Spring happening inside Saudi Arabia, the fact that they treat, 20% of the population as third-class citizens in the eastern province especially.
Oh, 80%, because you got to count 50% for all the women.
Right. And the fact that they treat 50% of their population as fourth class citizens.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Saudi Arabia, no question.
And they're horsing around in Yemen, and they're financing the Salafis in Syria.
Exactly. And they are financing jihadis all across the Middle East. As long as they, you know, stay away from Riyadh or Jeddah, wonderful. We'll give you weapons, we'll give you salaries, you know, you can kill other Muslims, especially Shiites, apostate Shiites, all right? But don't try to board a Saudi Arabian plane to come back here.
And in Africa, too, I had Thomas Mountain on a few weeks ago, and he made some strong evidence for Al-Shabaab in Somalia, where they're getting their money from, and it's got to be from these rich princes in Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's where all the... where every other investigation, when you look into these Wahhabis, Salafis, whatever you want to call them, it goes back to Saudi Arabia every time.
And absolutely.
They don't have this money. They're not generated themselves in Somalia.
It's Saudis, Kuwaitis, and Emiratis princes especially. wealthy private individuals as well, a few business pious businessmen, as they like to call them in the Middle East, you know. But that's it, and it's all based in the Gulf, and it's crazy because the Gulf is the, you know, it's another Western aircraft carrier over there in the Persian Gulf, you know, and that's why in the long run, I should be a hardcore nihilist by now, but I still keep an old romantic flame, you know, that, okay, maybe in the long run, people in the sea will wake up and see that their natural partnership in Southwest Asia is with Iran. It's not with these crazy Salafi Wahhabis, you know. It's going to take maybe decades, but one day they'll see the light. One day they'll see the light, you know.
A pivot to Persia.
A pivot to Persia.
You know, a lot of geopolitical analysts, we can see it a mile away, but when it gets to D.C. or wherever the government is, it gets confusing all of a sudden because they're basically bribed by so many different factions. And I don't know if they're that incompetent or malevolent or whatever it is, but they never do the right thing. But this time, because usually with Iran, when there's a deal, it's not really a deal because they put some impossible condition up there for them to reach that they're not going to have. And then they say, oh, see, they didn't want to do it. But this deal was different. It actually looked like it might work. Yeah. And then we had the French peacock. It was exactly. So close.
And it's in fact is astonishing, Ryan, that what, up to 5 or 6 days ago, they actually, I would say the P5 plus one, except France and the Iranians, they actually thought they had 90% of a deal on the table. They were extremely optimistic when they went to Geneva. The first day, at least, it was the first day of discussion was a Thursday, right?
Right.
And then thing derailed from Friday to Saturday, and on Sunday, total disaster. They left on Sunday morning, was a total disaster. But the fact that they got so close proves to you that, you know, there is goodwill on both sides. At least from what we can gather, we still don't know the devil in the details. They might come up at the last minute with something that Iran will say no, give up all the enriched uranium that you have. Obviously, they're going to say no. You have no right to enrich uranium from now on beyond 5%, for instance. They're going to say no as well. Because, you know, according to the NPT, they can enrich up to 20%. But for the moment, nobody was talking in these radical terms until this weekend. No?
Yeah, last minute sabotage.
Yeah.
Hell, that's the Israeli lobby's effect on different countries. But I'm glad you pointed out the GCC influence on France, because that is not as obvious, I guess. And also their influence in D.C., but they don't really compare to AIPAC. But that is another major player, and it is odd. We have this war on terrorism, and yet we support the most prolific states of terrorism in the world, Israel and Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. Exactly. And in fact, their lobby in both London and Paris is extremely sophisticated. And it's very simple. It's a follow the money thing. You know, when British and French businesses look at the Gulf, all that oil, money and all that, and they need everything because, first of all, they're incompetent to build anything. They don't have, their ruling class is practically illiterate, with the exception of a few princes who studied in Cambridge, Oxford, maybe Harvard, MIT, etc. It's a very small minority. It's not enough to rule all these countries, you know. So they need Westerners for everything, from being, you know, museum guards to, you know, desk clerks. Two hardcore managers.
They had to get Bechtel to go in and build their trash cleanup because they were using goats before that.
Absolutely.
That's as real. I'm not making that up. I'm not trying to be funny. That is exactly what happened. That's the level of incompetence they have, and that, you know, because they're alienating 50% of their brains, because the girls have what we call a pink collar job, and they just, a lot of them are just going to religious schools. Which aren't not like religious schools in the United States, or whatever. This is fundamental, like I would just call it backwards. I'm sorry, but it's just they're not studying the sciences and things they need to know. And they don't have enough engineers. They have all these weapons, like they have all these useless F-35s and things, and they don't have enough pilots to even fly them. They're just there as a way of kind of a gift to the MIC in America for political policies to say, okay, we'll buy X number of this stuff even though we can't even use it.
It's a petrodollar recycling, in fact.
Petrodollar recycling, there you go.
Fabulous deal for the military industrial complex in the US and obviously the European EADS, for instance, you know, the British French military technology corporation. It's a great deal for them. You know, let's sell everything we have for those suckers. You know, they don't know how to do anything, so we'll keep sending, you know, we can charge for maintenance, we can charge for personnel, we can export our personnel over there, we can create jobs over here. It's a fabulous deal. You know, they're the perfect clients. And in terms of military,
I think they're the largest clients as well.
Yes, they are.
I think more than Israel, which Israel's not even spending their own money. They're spending our money. Saudi Arabia at least spends their own money on the MIC.
They're spending American money, absolutely. And you know, in terms of military, what are the Saudis going to do with all this heavy weaponry? You know, they never fought a war. They don't know how to fight any war. And who are they going to fight? You know, their own people. There's no one. Iran is never going to attack anybody in the Persian Gulf. They need alliances with these crazy Wahhabis, and they need them more or less contained. They will never attack anybody. So you know, the only point for you know Qatar, for instance, they remember during the first days of the bombing of Libya, né? They sent a few of their F-16s, whatever. That's it, you know, just for show. I think they were not flying them, you know. So it's a joke. In military terms, the six GCC countries are an absolute joke. But it's not a joke if you are doing business in the military vein in the U.S. and London and Paris.
Yeah, that's all it is. It's sick. It's a death industry. That's all that is, making money off of you. At least they're not using them so much, but they buy these things, and they sure as hell finance terrorists all over the world, and it's just a disgusting gambit. But I think things can change. We have the new talks, the new round, I guess, on the 20th and 22nd, is it? Or is it just 20th?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, can we offer the French something to make them shut up and go away? Like, this is such a good deal for everybody involved. It seems like something's got to give, and I'm still being optimistic about it because I want to be.
you know what, Ryan? I think I was thinking about this today. In fact, this change of narrative by Kerry maybe is a way of placating the French. In fact,
that's what some people were saying. I think John Glasser was saying that could be just a diplomatic move. You know.
So if Kerry came up with that, kudos for him. He's not very bright in this, but if he had the idea, it's a good idea. Okay, for the moment we blame Iran. We say, look, they were not ready for a deal. Maybe next time, etc.
Yeah, and we save face, because the only people that know the French really sabotaged it are people that listen to independent media.
It's true. It's true. If you read mainstream media, you won't know that the French sabotaged it. Mm. Period. And that's an enormous problem. Enormous problem. You know, but of course, the Russians and the Chinese know it. But most of the rest of the world, they don't.
But that's an interesting point, though, because Kerry did do that. And if he is saving face for them, I mean, the only purpose for that would be so in the future they can change it, you know.
Shut up. Let us, the grown-ups, I'm saying the opponent is straight, or the grown-ups. They're grown-ups, right?
Shut up. Let us closer to being grown-up people talk.
And you stick to drinking Bordeaux and eating Brie, which, by the way, you do it very well.
Oh, that's horrible. Is that? But again, I'm glad the French people are fed up with it. But I think they were already mad because of the economic situations they've gotten themselves into anyway. But
You should see Paris last week. My impression was that the local, and in fact, some of my friends actually told me that the local Parisians are almost gone. The city is a paradise for wealthy tourists from emerging markets. Like, I saw busloads of Chinese everywhere. Unbelievable. You know, they were congesting the streets, you know, buying, like, shopping like crazy. And obviously, a lot of people, even in Paris, they gave up. If they are unemployed, some living in the streets, it's heartbreaking to really? See that. Oh, yeah, in such a beautiful. I remember I lived in Paris a little bit in the 70s, back and forth in the 80s. I lived there half of the 90s. And now, every time that I go back, the first thing, I like walking early in the morning. And you see people who actually spend the night in the street, something that you never saw in Paris until a few years ago. It's really heartbreaking, you know. And, you know, these people, some are still, they still, you know, they dress in a dignified way. Some of them, even they refuse to beg. They just put a very small sign saying, "I'm hungry," which in France is it's extremely powerful. And a lot of people, they give them at least a few coins, you know. It's really heartbreaking because these people, they have nothing anymore. They don't have social security for some reason. Don't have family anymore. It is as heartbreaking as in the U.S., as you see it in New York, in Chicago, in L.A., you know. Yeah. It's.
But in the U.S., we have no social programs at all, really. So you can see that. I mean, a lot of people, the number one cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. is the U.S. healthcare system, but that's another issue. So, but thanks for your time today, and I look forward to your analysis after the next round of negotiations, and hopefully cooler heads can prevail and they can tell the Israeli lobbies both in France and the U.S. to stick it, as well as the GCC, because the writing's on the wall, and I think maybe, like you said, it'll take decades, but I'm hoping it'll be a little faster.
Wonderful, Ryan. I want to share your optimism. You know,
I'm never optimistic, you know that. I'm always like, no, they're not going to do that. But I really think, just this once, I really think there is a shot at this because of what Kerry did, and you know I'm not a fan of his. I can't stand him. But it, for their own selfish interests, they have overlapping interests. There are reasons why, because they can all profit out of it, that they'll do the right thing for the wrong reason kind of scenario. And I really think we could get a deal.
Absolutely right, Ryan. And if something happens after next week, then we can talk about what the Obama administration and American capital wants from Iran if they clinch a deal. Because the possibilities are fascinating in business-wise and geostrategically as well. If this happens, you know, sooner or later, I would say sooner rather than later, they can dump these Wahhabis for good, in fact.
I know. There's so much potential, and we can talk about that next time too. But let's not get ahead of ourselves, because it all depends on if they get it. But if they get it, as like you said, there's a lot of good things that will come out of that. Not just for business, but everything.
Perfect, my man.
All right, Pepe. Thank you for coming back again. I think you're tied for the most interviewed person, maybe. So. But I'll have you on after the talks. So take care.
All right. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, man.